Hi, it's Dave. ARK Invest is transforming how we think about investing through their research and innovation-focused investing approach. Today, I'm joined by Brett Winton. He is the Director of Research at ARK Invest, and we'll be discussing how to understand where the world is headed and how that can give us advantages as investors. I've also asked Emmett Peppers, who's a frequent guest on my channel, to join in with some questions. Hi, Brett. How are you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. And Emmett, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, yeah. We just chatted last night, so it's good chatting. I like hanging out with you, Dave. This is a great opportunity to chat with Brett here and get some insights from their perspective.
Awesome. So, Brett, just a few days ago, you guys released your new Tesla price target. I want to go into that, but I also want to, the bigger picture or kind of idea of this interview, I really want to dive deep into your thinking process on how you research, how you find the big trends, how you view the future, and if that can unlock any insights for us as investors to give us kind of that edge. But first, regarding Tesla, I know you guys have been big bulls on Tesla. You updated your price target. I'm curious, can you give us a background and context on like why you guys updated your price target? Like what were the main driving factors in making kind of the new price target?
Sure. Well, I mean, a year had passed. So roughly a year ago was the last time we did a major update to it. Over the course of the last year, I'd say our perspective on their strategic optionality with regards to vertically integrating through ride hail had evolved. And so Tasha Keeney, who covers Autonomous Force, actually published a blog detailing how we thought they had tactical strategic advantage in that space. So internally, we had our expectations for future value of the company had shifted. We think that we owe, since we do have this open source model that's out there, it's kind of, reasonable and responsible for us to update it with some periodicity. And so thought we would release that out to the world. And from our perspective, the reason we are transparent about what we believe, the reason we try to publish to the world, like this is what we think is going to happen, is because then we get this feedback that is sometimes positive and constructive and sometimes not, but that then gives us an idea of where the controversies lie, you know, where we could do more work, where kind of our expectation is disconnected from other people's expectations. And so, and also kind of this attitude of transparency of trying to share what you believe with the world really forces us as a research team to do a good job of documenting and justifying the conditions upon which we are building our models. And so it allows us internally to be more transparent and then to the external world to be more transparent. And so this is part, Tesla's not the only company that we have open source models on. Over time, I anticipate we will do more of it, and we have, some in the works. It is a heavy lift relative to kind of compliance and for the evolution of the Tesla model, getting it to a point where it was relatively insulated from people trying to manipulate it in a way that produced out like absurd results at the tails of the inputs. Was its own development process that has been interesting. And now we've gotten it to that stage, but kind of building a fully tuned model that has independent variables that then results in kind of a reasonable spectrum of outcomes that also allows people to manipulate those variables in the way that they want is not, it's actually not an elementary thing to do. And so adapting kind of the internal model we were using to a model that is then externalizable has been a process over time. And it's something that we aim to do for a number of companies as we continue to develop.
Yeah. I mean, it's great you guys share the model. You guys, go out, talk to people. You're open to retail investors. I think by doing that, you've not just also kind of disrupting how investing is done on the institutional side, but you're bringing in a ton of retail investors into kind of the whole nitty gritty of how to research companies, how to view companies, how to see the future. I'm curious if you could, with Tesla, if you could walk through us with us more of the unit economics on how you see kind of the robotaxi market evolve. I know in previous interviews you've said that you see kind of robotaxi becoming a $1 trillion earnings. The companies on the robotaxi platform or autonomous ride hailing can accrue $1 trillion in earnings by, I'm not sure when the time frame is, but if you could kind of walk us through a bit of what the robotaxi or autonomous ride hailing unit economics are, like cost per mile, platform cost, how large you think this opportunity can be.
Yeah. So, and I'll start at the technology level, and maybe I'll give you a little insight into how we're thinking about Tesla's strategic positioning as well. But generally, we believe that robotaxis at equilibrium, once they've fully penetrated, will price at about 25 cents per mile. So imagine an Uber or a Lyft, but it costs one-tenth the cost. And then think for yourself internally, how would that change your way in which you approach like the idea of how do I get from place to place? Right now, if you take an Uber, like if you were to take an Uber for 100% of your trips, that would be the equivalent of buying like a $200,000 car, right? So it's really for the power of the ride hail model is you get chauffeured travel, but selectively, but you get all of the benefits of chauffeured travel selectively, right? And if you look at kind of the reason you buy a car is you're buying a car that produces you a bundle of miles at a relatively low cost. So if you buy a new car in the US, a midsize sedan, you're paying something like 70 cents per mile once you take into account kind of the depreciation of the vehicle and the insurance and you have to change the tires and the gas and everything else. And electric vehicles are cheaper, that run cheaper than that, but you're paying more upfront for it. So there's like a trade-off there. So our belief is that robo-taxis, because they can operate at a much higher utilization than normal cars. So like you buy a car and you leave it parked 95% of the time, that's a huge waste. Robo-taxi will run maybe 40 to 50% of the time. And because they're on electric drivetrain platforms, so the operating cost will be low, albeit with slightly higher, at least at this point, upfront cost, that they'll be able to price it 25 cents per mile. The marginal cash operating cost of driving a Toyota Camry is about 30 cents per mile, meaning that if a robo-taxi prices at 25 cents a mile, you will literally be saving money by sitting in the back seat and watching Netflix than if you were to try to drive yourself. Even ignoring, like not even taking into account, like if you fully paid off the vehicle and you're never planning on selling it, you're better off leaving it in the garage. So with that as the context, you can see how we conclude that a huge number of miles are going to shift over onto robotaxi. And you'll actually have a lot more miles demanded. Like traffic's going to get worse because it's going to be so inexpensive and so convenient to ride in these vehicles instead of driving yourself. So then you think about, and this is generally how we might go about one of our exercises, is to start at the top down, do kind of the demand elasticity, the unit cost of providing the service, and then think about where in the value chain we believe cash flow is going to accrue. And so we think that the majority of cash flow in this robotaxi case is likely to accrue to the software platform provider who provide that functionality. In the case of Tesla, it could be vertically integrated through manufacturing, or it could be a Waymo-type company or a Baidu-type company that's providing a software to a set of manufacturers who also are able to make some money on it, but most of the cash flow accrues to that software layer. And so just like with Uber or Lyft, that software layer will charge some kind of platform fee against the 25 cent per mile price. And that platform fee will be like kind of software margin profitability characteristics. And the sheer volume of miles that's going to shift onto these platforms then leads you to, you know, pretty dramatic conclusions in terms of the amount of accessible cash flow for these businesses. If you think about it, the reason why is because there is a huge economic waste in the fact that there are so many amateur drivers in the world. Like the average American spends an hour driving a day. You're not getting paid for that. It's quite boring. And so kind of turning that hour a day of unpaid labor into something where you're paying a company to provide that service and then freeing up your own time to ostensibly do work or check email, but realistically watch Netflix is a big economic value creation event. And so like as with a lot of innovations, it takes non-market activity and turns it into market activity in a win-win situation for the person who's purchasing it and the company that's providing it. So that gives you like a high level view of how we think it's going to shake out.
Okay. So let's imagine, let's say 15, 20 years, let's get say way out in the future, ride hailing is 25 cents per mile, autonomous ride hailing. What would you imagine the platform fee to be in that case?
Yeah, so I think we've underwritten the platform fees at something like 30%. So imagine 25 cents a mile and call it 7.5 cents in platform fee. Mm-hmm. And then there are 10 trillion miles globally, roughly. And I might be getting these numbers slightly off, but 10 trillion miles, but demand elasticity drives mileage through the roof. So we think it goes to something like 30 trillion. And so do 30 trillion times 7.5 cents, and that mm-hmm. gets you your net revenue line. So, you know, 30, I can't do it in my head, but, yeah, no, 30 trillion. Oh yeah. Yeah. So roughly 3 trillion, call it 3 trillion,
yeah,
okay. give or take in net revs. Right. Mm-hmm. And then, whatever, you know, so you can see, I don't have like the exact way we did platform fee. Cause I think, so out of that, you strip an EBITDA multiple. I mean, an EBITDA margin. And, you know, the way I've done the math, I would suggest you could do it on a 30% EBITDA margin. But I'm pretty sure we've underwritten a higher EBITDA margin and maybe a lower platform fee to end up at a trillion operating earnings.
Brett, does ARK Invest have any kind of opinion on what countries or jurisdictions might allow for a kind of a mass adoption robo-taxi network first? Like China maybe might be more aggressive or parts of the US or Europe or any opinion on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think different regulators have approached it in different ways. It seems China is pushing their, you know, locals to do vehicle to infrastructure communication to enable it. And it seems to me it's the kind of implementation that could only succeed in China, as in you need to be willing to put in a lot of CapEx, capital expenditures to build out the infrastructure to support it. If you end up with an autonomous system that is reliant on vehicle to infrastructure communication, then it gets very fragile if it moves outside of wherever you've built out the specific infrastructure for it. So we don't think it scales necessarily very well, but you know, China could do it. But then it also probably means the solutions that are there have a hard time working outside of China. In the US, you know, there's like the licensing body. So you get a driver's license from your state, not the federal government. And so if you're considering these cars, the effective drivers, then maybe those should be state licensed. And then there's the, you know, federal government does manufacturing safety. And so it's like not totally clear exactly how kind of the regulations will be administered in the US, but the fact that there is state by state variance means that states are competing to try to let companies, you know, safely test in their geographies. Ultimately,
it's a good thing.
It's going to be a situation where some company, you know, demonstrates they can do it safely and at scale. And then it becomes like such a compelling commercial product that then consumers agitate. Why is it that I get to Las Vegas or I get to cross the Nevada border and then I can have a car take me the rest of the way to Las Vegas very inexpensively? Why can't I just travel from my home in Los Angeles? Right. And so kind of that to me seems like a natural mechanism by which it eventually rolls out. But as far as I understand it, basically the US and China have been more lenient, whereas Europe has been a little more restrictive on the ability of these companies to kind of experiment and try to move forward with the technology. And you have to accommodate there is political risk in that, you know, as with Uber, these systems are not going to be safe. And an autonomous taxi is, likely upon commercial rollout going to kill fewer people than traditional taxis, but they will be much more newsworthy when they do so. And so kind of like the political apparatus is always, you know, risk averse to media interest, not to actual statistical risk. So there's probably like a higher safety hurdle you need to cross before you can, you know, really roll it out at scale. Even if you can demonstrate that you're much safer than, you know, the average 16-year-old driver who's trying to film a TikTok and Snapchat while driving around town.
Do you think, Brett, do you think the autonomous ride-hailing network is a winner-takes-most market? For example, with various technologies, you have various network effects, which give, you know, the largest company, you know, the ability to give a better, higher value proposition to customers and get an inordinate amount of market share. Do you think that applies to autonomous ride hailing? Will the winner take most, or will it be more of a divided, you know, marketplace eventually when it reaches equilibrium?
I mean, I think it definitely has natural monopoly effects embedded in the way the businesses will work, but I think it'll probably be geography by geography. You know, Tesla, I think China is the Chinese player's market to lose because the playing field will be tilted towards them. And in the US, you know, you could even have some cities that are Waymo cities and then rest of country is Tesla or something like that. But the reason why it's a natural monopoly is because, you know, you are have your assets in a city. One, you have like, If Uber or Lyft has any barrier to entry, then this must be like an order of magnitude greater than that, because your assets are then generating your data that allows your assets to be more performative. It allows, you know, the first car that goes through the construction site will have a harder time than the 10th, right? And so kind of the consumer is unlikely to tolerate being stuck on the side of the road in the Bing mobile while kind of Waymo is zipping by them, right? And so insofar as you begin to occupy a city, get better data off of it, you get consumer or demand liquidity out of the consumers, and then you're collecting ongoing data that improves the quality of your service in that specific geography, then you'll be able to essentially make it very difficult for a competitor to come in and compete.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the autonomous ride-hailing miles, let's say going from 10 trillion miles a year to, let's say, 20 or 30 trillion miles a year, even if the platforms take, let's say, 5% at 20 trillion miles, that's $1 trillion in earnings, right? When you think about that, like, do you foresee autonomous ride-hailing miles overtake human-driven miles? And if so, at what junction or what kind of time frame do you imagine that to happen?
Yes, yeah. Like, our belief is that it'll be a... you'll be more likely to ride in a robo-taxi than you will to drive yourself. And in fact, the situations in which you drive yourself will be kind of specialized situations. Same with internal combustion versus electric vehicle. Like, I think that, you know, there are still people who buy, and in fact, it's a growing part of the market, but that buy records and play LPs, you know, vinyl, right? And they have a really good sound system, presumably. And so kind of like the quality of the music is better for them. You know, if you are wanting to drive across the Sahara Desert, an electric vehicle, unless you have good solar panels on it, I guess, is probably not going to be your choice for, you know, out the back of the time horizon that we consider. However, we believe that electric vehicles will be sticker price competitive with internal combustion engine, the median internal combustion engine by 2023. So like a 350-mile range EV will basically be the same cost up front as a Toyota Camry, but it'll be more performative, cost you less over time, and you don't have to go to the gas station every couple weeks, and there won't be as much maintenance. But it won't stop there. By 2025, like that same 350-mile vehicle with the same fit and finish as a Toyota Camry will be $18,000, and the Toyota Camry will still be $26,000, right? And so it would be a huge surprise if the market didn't invert, right? And so similarly, you know, insofar as autonomous capability kind of leapfrogs geography by geography, regulator by regulator, and becomes available, you know, who is going to continue to insist upon kind of buying you know, a second or third car when you can save money and not be bothered with driving to ride around the back seat by going in robo-taxis. And so, and it also opens up the market. So it's not just like the driving age population. For one thing, you know, many elderly people probably shouldn't be driving at this point, but they still are because they need to have that independence. And kind of the 15s and 16-year-olds, you know, they probably should be going around and seeing the world, but in the current state of affairs, maybe they can't. But at some point, they will be able to do so again, and they won't have to beg mom and dad to take them to the movies, assuming movies are still a thing that people go to, you know. And so, and then in a geography like China, only 20% of the population is licensed to drive. And there's also, should unlock kind of ridership in those geographies as well. Mm-hmm. I'd say one complicating factor is that how kind of autonomous robo-taxis cross paths with kind of micro-mobility solutions, which are really energy efficient and great and interesting. To support this. Limitations to model, but you future work better world or zipping around on scooters and stuff, just in geographies like the US, it just doesn't seem like that's something that we're culturally able to get to.
Makes sense.
With regard to the Tesla analysis, does ARC, I'm just curious, does ARC have like a direct line with Elon by any chance? Or if not, I mean, if it does, would it even be allowed to talk about it, I guess, too?
No, we have no, I mean, you know, we follow him on Twitter.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I know you've had him on your like podcast. I was wondering if like you guys corresponded about your now and he gave you feedback or anything, but nothing like that, huh?
I mean, historically, you know, as a lot of people do when we publish this stuff, you know, certainly their investor relations team looks at it and he has as well. I mean, he's responded to tweets about the valuation work that we've done. My guess is like, I think that you know, the really groundbreaking work, I think in the modeling we've done on Tesla is how we treat the cost decline potential of the business. So the ability to deliver gross margin into the vehicle line. And I suspect that Elon looks at that and says, that makes sense, that's what we should target. And the people who are having to deliver that look at him and be like, you're crazy, right? Like, because there's, you know, so Wright's law, which is how we do cost declines, for every cumulative doubling of production, you get a consistent percent cost decline, and that you're wearing the shirt, so you should.
Yeah, I love your swag, yeah.
Yeah. So what's funny about that is we were applying that to industrial robots. So Sam was doing this work and we end up at a robot cost that was half of what Boston Consulting Group was forecasting. And the way Boston Consulting Group did, and which is ironic because Boston Consulting Group was one of the first organizations to begin to try to systematically implement Wright's Law, or at least to propagate its use. But in that Boston Consulting Group report, what they did is they interviewed and surveyed all the people who were doing kind of actually the robot manufacturing, engineering, and design. And you can imagine that person at that level, the BCG says, well, what can you deliver in cost declines? He's like, nothing. I can deliver nothing. This is not going down in price. I'm at the margin I can tolerate right now. There's no way that we're going to, you know, I'll give up 2% a year. Fine. Just go away. Right. But if you like back up a level and look at it from like a high level view and look at the cumulative production of robots and the cost decline that they followed, it's a very clean Wright's Law distribution. So it would be actually a huge surprise if these guys who were like, there's no way I can deliver cost declines, didn't actually figure out ways to deliver them. They just don't know how it's going to happen yet. And the law is, kind of because it can operate at different scales, for example, you know, within the robotic space, it's like, do your actuators need to be as precise if you can have kind of a camera on the front end to allow you to refine your movements as you get closer to the object? And the answer is no. So then you find cost savings there. It's like the cost savings can come outside of the specialization of the person who is currently trying to solve the problems. And so kind of it's just like accommodates a lot of human ingenuity that kind of a narrower perspective on how you can deliver costs, might not believe or might not imagine are out there. Yes, I think that some of the people inside of Tesla probably look at our forecasts and say, how many units are you expecting us to deliver and how are we actually supposed to do that? But then from our perspective, it's like we think we have a good read on what is possible given kind of other technologies and the way they've proliferated and the way that kind of you can scale them. Then dimension that out and do it in part so people can see it and be like, oh, you're crazy about this and here's why. And it helps us to think through, are we crazy? Like, what are the risks to this particular forecast? So long way of saying, I think from like Elon's level, it's probably like, great, now I can turn this around and like throw it at the engineers and be like, this is what you should do. I think from the kind of like engineers level, they're like, this is, you know, for instance, you would never, I don't think you would ever get their investor relations team to endorse kind of the targets that we think are achievable for them.
So some of these crazy targets, I want to get your feedback. So, I mean, you just mentioned the 2023 a comparable EV to a Camry would be cheaper. And then by 2025, you think that perhaps it'll go down to what, even 18,000 compared to 26,000, let's say, Camry. And then you're also forecasting perhaps if everything goes right with supply and OEMs, like the market for electric vehicles could be as high as 40 million by 2025. Some of this stuff seems like, wow, it's like what's, just in 2 years, 2023, what car is going to be better than a Camry at 26,000? Is it the Model 2 or are there other cars you think the OEMs are going to be releasing? And by 2025, is there going to be something under $20,000 that's better than a Camry? Is Tesla even preparing for that? Or is that just how the Model 2 is going to, you know, go down in trajectory in terms of price? Like, how are you practically kind of, you know, foreseeing kind of some of these projections?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to like, how are we de-risking the forecast? Like, cause one thing that people say, it's like, well, what specifically, for instance, with our Tesla forecast, it's like, well, where are they going to build the plants? It's like, that's not my decision to make, right? You know, I know that they'll generate the cash flow sufficient to build the plants. And I think that they've demonstrated their ability to like build a manufacturing assembly plant in record time. And that there will be kind of a strategic matrix they're having to go through to think about, well, this is where this plant goes, or this is how much capacity we can shove through the Texas factory, given you don't have a paint shop there. Like, you know, there's like various things they can consider. In some ways, we're just saying, well, this is what, so take the EV forecast. We're looking at the battery level and the battery cost decline. Basically, like, what is the cost per kilowatt hour do we think is deliverable given the Wright's Law battery cost decline, which has held since like 1995, right? And given the volumes that we anticipate. And then how much additional spend you have to do on top of drivetrain to produce the vehicle with like appropriate fit and finish. And then we do some de-risking work about like, well, then in internal combustion land, like what is kind of like the outside of drivetrain, like how much do people spend even on these lower cost vehicles on like producing the, you know, the interior of a Ford Fiesta or something like that. We're not trying to say, oh, 2023, this is the model that is going to be cost competitive. It could be that Tesla announces something at that time. The Chinese manufacturers are also, standardizing on kind of battery platforms in a way that suggests they could deliver that kind of capability. And we could be off by a year. Like there's definitely X-axis variance in that forecast. The level at which I'm comfortable is to say, these are better vehicles that are soon gonna cost less out of pocket than a traditional vehicle. And so then to say, there's demand for 40 million, that probably, you know, that builds in a lot of friction. If you think of the motor vehicle market as like a 100 million unit market, and I'm saying that you can either pay $26,000 for a worse product or $18,000 for a, you know, more performative, saves you money over time product, and still 60% of the market is going to be buying this $8,000 more product. That's like, I'm, you know, there is some like amount of, you know, whether it's charging infrastructure friction, kind of multifamily households being less amenable because they don't have a spot to charge it. Like there's a lot, and just like figuring out distribution and supply constraints on the battery cell supply side. We've built a lot into saying this doesn't all happen at once. But it's kind of, to me, obvious. And though it's not inevitable, because I'm not always right, and I reserve the right to be wrong, I think it's inevitable. Mm-hmm. And within the 40 million units, there's also a question of like, what comes out of China? There's a whole class of vehicle, like the neighborhood electric vehicle, which has been basically not efficiently served to date, where there are interesting design implementations there. And I think that could be a really, like, I've always thought that was the route that Apple should have at this point already gotten to. And you know, we'll see. But I think that the current set of internal combustion engine manufacturers still are not taking electric drivetrains seriously enough, given the capital plans that they have. They're still like underwriting their capital investments as if this is something that's going to be driven only by kind of subsidy and regulatory impulse. It's going to be a consumer demand-driven technology change. And until they come to that realization and begin, you know, until they jump off their burning oil platforms, to use like the ex-CEO of Nokia's metaphor, then kind of you're not going to get the, at least within that manufacturing footprint, the supply online that you need to facilitate that transition. So the risk there is clearly, it's basically like these incumbents, like how do they convince their shareholders that they need to totally degrade out of their internal combustion engine manufacturing capability? And not only convince their shareholders, but how are they themselves going to like come to terms with that reality? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Who do you see as kind of the main competitor to Tesla? I mean, you mentioned OEMs are going to probably have a hard time. Is it, you know, the Chinese companies like NIO and XPeng and Li? Is it perhaps an Apple, or is it, you know, NVIDIA, or are these different, you know, autonomous driving solutions the main competitors, like Mobileye or Comma.ai or Cruise, et cetera? What are your thoughts with competition?
Well, I think you can think about it on just the electric vehicle production standpoint. And I don't, you know, it's like Volkswagen, I think, will produce a credible product. I certainly hope so. And Ford, you know, I haven't actually driven a Mach-E, but I think people like it. Like, you know, I think the OEM should, you know, scale production. They're just not being as aggressive about it as they could be. And GM's product is like reasonable as well. Hyundai, like there are, our read of it is basically the traditional OEM space is, call it 3 years behind where Tesla is in terms of battery and drivetrain, maybe four, given how long it'll take them to vertically integrate or to create kind of cell to vehicle configurations. So maybe five, but the issue for those OEMs and for anybody, so then that's one class where they're 3 to 4 years behind, which translates into their cost to produce is something like 40% higher than Tesla's. Or Tesla could get 40% gross margin and they'd be at cost competitive, they'd be at, you know, zero margin because of the degree to which the costs are declining across the entire technology stack. Okay, so then there's another set of competitors, which are more the startup, you know, from scratch, let's build EVs. I think those companies are really interesting. Without commenting on their valuation, you know, which we look at all of them, but I think it's a challenge for us to kind of understand how the market is, you know, anticipating value accrual for those companies. But you know, I think that the transition, the technology transition is so severe that you're almost better off starting from a blank slate rather than trying to like Frankenstein your way from a traditional manufacturing footprint into electric vehicle. And so over time, they should be there should be credible products coming out of whichever of those, you know, startup EV manufacturers survive, you know, kind of their capital starved scaling. And then I think the Chinese players are clearly, you know, going to scale. The Chinese government has an interest in supporting its kind of battery supply chain. You know, there's a lot of manufacturers in China who are clearly trying to figure out how to piece together the right drivetrain stack to compete. And I think it's reasonably likely that this becomes the mechanism by which Chinese car exports gain a much bigger foothold in the global marketplace. You know, they've always kind of been or never really been able to successfully export, certainly not to the U.S. But I think that it's this transition is a good opportunity for them. And given kind of the Chinese government's, again, subsidy and support of the battery supply chain, it actually puts them in a reasonably good spot to do so. And so I think that's kind of like, so that's at the manufacturing level. At the autonomous level, you know, it's totally clear that Waymo has a much more performative system than Tesla does now, as does Cruise, as does a number. Basically, you know, there's a lot of startups that saw what Waymo was doing and said, okay, we'll do that. You know, we'll do high definition mapping with LiDAR and try to like basically customize, solve every single corner case, decide exactly where the car needs to stop at every single stop sign, you know, basically dimension the problem to death, but taking in a ton of data to try to solve it at a citywide scale. And those systems, as you would expect, are massively more performative than Tesla's full self-driving beta right now. I think with the case of Waymo, which is the only one to really commercialize, they're a competitor. It's a question of how long does it take them to go from one city to another city, and then to what degree can they actually scale manufacturing of vehicles to their technology stack without, you know, encountering performance problems. And given the announced build plans they have with Jaguar and who's their other partner? It's Fiat, I guess. They, you know, unless Tesla can't get to market within the next 5 years, it seems as if Waymo's not going to have the distribution that Tesla has. And so there's, you know, a question of does this solution that can you have to build kind of city by city in an extremely kind of intricate manner, and you have to build up kind of a manufacturing base to manufacture the vehicles that are going to run it. Is that solution going to be the winning solution, or is Tesla, which is on a raw capability level behind, but has the you know the data input layer and basically the call it the test fleet of people, you know, I use autopilot all the time, right? Like, does that data asset allow them to continue to accelerate and advance on a degraded sensor set to the point where they are as capable as Waymo, but they can do it, you know, launching in multiple cities at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I think probably Waymo is the US competitor. I think in Japan, you know, there's, it would not surprise me if a Japanese national champion was basically allowed to win the Japanese market for robotaxi. Like it would probably be more surprising if it was not a, you know, domestic company than not. And then in China, like the way we've underwritten Tesla full self-driving in China is basically they get a severely degraded platform fee because they'll have to partner with some local entity because that's just the only possible way they'll be allowed to take any share in that market, is our belief. And Tesla's not designing the vehicle to infrastructure. So if kind of that is, can if your ability to operate in that market is contingent on you communicating with the smart infrastructure, which the Chinese governments or at least municipalities could clearly do if they wanted to, then they could be shut out of that market. So, you know, I think ultimately, and then Europe is kind of a right now, who knows, but Tesla probably has a little bit of a lead there. But the, you know, I do think you'll end up with like each geography will have a company that's dominant there. And it's the, you know, people don't like the uncertainty, the fact that you can't say assuredly, oh, well, this is the company that's going to win here. If you invert it and say, well, there is going to be a winning set of companies that's worth north of $10 trillion. And if I kind of invest my assets in a pool of them, right, and I don't know which ones are going to win, but I'm fairly certain I have access to a couple of them that will. I actually don't care what happens to the other ones that don't, right? Because the upside is so asymmetric, right? And that's the, you know, and so long as you have like a balanced portfolio where that upside is kind of like idiosyncratic, like it happens randomly for this particular technology, but it doesn't happen for that technology, well, then you have access to that asymmetric skew. And like if you are placing enough idiosyncratic bets in that way, then your portfolio characteristics look very good, right? Because you end up with, you know, high return. The cases where things don't work out, you know, are dwarfed by the returns you get on the cases that they do, where they do, and kind of you do very well as a, you know, a person with that set of exposures.
Mm-hmm. Is that type of approach kind of what you guys are doing with the genomic space and CRISPR? Is kind of you're confident that the genomics CRISPR space is going to be 10x, 100x, just it's going to grow just hugely, and you're spreading out your bets because, I mean, is part of the spreading out the bets, I guess my question is it because there isn't that clear winner in the early stages, but you know there will be a clear winner eventually, so you want to be invested in that area, or is there some other kind of strategy or approach behind that?
Yeah, so just at a high level, our belief is that like the ability to directly manipulate the genome is a new technology capability unlocked that will yield all kinds of benefits over time. You'll take, you know, rare diseases. 1 in 100 babies is born with a monogenic disease, and the cost of treating these rare diseases, and you're basically just managing symptoms, can be $100,000 a year. So if you can deliver a cure, if you basically can use gene editing to change that kind of monogenic mutation and cure the disease rather than manage symptoms, the value of that cure, leaving aside the way in which you improve that person's life, but the value of that cure should be, you know, more than $1 million, because you're avoiding a lifetime's worth of symptom management, which is very expensive. And so it's clear to us that kind of gene editing and CRISPR, which is a you know, style of gene editing, which is inexpensive, it allows rapid experimentation, and it was just really discovered in over the last business cycle, will be a tool that can potentially address that 1 in 100 babies, all those monogenic diseases. Then on top of that, you have, you know, almost all diseases are actually genetic diseases in some way. Right. And so you have polygenic diseases where it's like more than one mutation that is causing kind of this disorder that your body's experiencing. And so kind of it's likely that gene editing will also play a role in developing new treatments against those polygenic diseases. And so kind of the set of addressable diseases and the economic value of those addressable diseases, just on the monogenic side, we think it's something like a $70 billion annual market, but there's huge latent demand because there's a population that has, you know, sickle cell anemia and beta thal and all these other things that would also, you know, love to not have to do 18 blood transfusions a year because of the disease they have, right? And so if you total up all of the latent demand for these cures, if they were to come out, it's more than $1 trillion. There's also, because you have combination of gene editing, gene sequencing, and advanced machine learning techniques, including like neural networks, that are improving your ability to move any drug through the clinical pipeline. So like an early stage asset that you haven't even deployed into humans yet, Well, like to find, to create a mouse that exactly matches the disorder that you're trying to test that asset against used to be a multi-month process, and you couldn't actually create the custom mouse. But with gene editing, you can create a much better match for the specific hamster you're trying to test against. You can do it in weeks. And so your odds of actually identifying the drug that will work are higher. And that applies all along the kind of clinical trial pipeline process. And so our belief is that every clinical trial pipeline is going to be, that at least is trying to deploy these technologies aggressively, is going to get more efficient, and that you don't need, you won't have as many failures at each stage in the process. And that effect compounds. So actually earlier stage assets are more valuable on a relative basis than late stage assets than they used to be. And so from a deployment of capital perspective, you can apply that lens across the entire clinical pipeline landscape and be like, oh, I'm buying basically this R&D at an undervalued basis because the return on that R&D is going to be higher than people understand. And because of the way kind of the biotech and pharma market works out, there's a lot of people going after a lot of these different diseases. And it's really hard to call beforehand, oh, this one's going to work and this one's not going to work. And in fact, it's really, you just have to treat it as a game of probability where it's, I think this is the odds that this is going to work, and this is the odds that this is going to work. And so with that as the context, having like a broader set of exposures is a better portfolio move rather than being like, I'm going to put all of my eggs in this one basket where then I subject myself more completely to that idiosyncratic single risk. Mm-hmm.
Do you think there will ever be a Tesla of genomics? Are you guys looking for that, or are you guys just resolved to, you know, invest in whatever you find to be the best available players in the market?
I think that there's only going to be a Tesla of Tesla, just like there's only an Apple of Apple, right? But I think the question you're trying to get at is, will there be some like giant, like dominant company that sits within the genomic space? And it's certainly possible. And in fact, I think that something that may play out or within markets that people aren't anticipating is that you will end up with really big companies across a lot of different sectors where previously there was more fragmentation. And so it used to be people were like, well, a single company worth $1 trillion, who could imagine, right? And so now there's, how many do we have now? Four, three, whatever, right? And if you look at the way we've underwritten Tesla, we also expect that, you know, probability weighted Tesla is going to be worth more than $1 trillion, right? And because technology does lead itself into these natural monopoly effects and does tend to concentrate markets, I think in a lot of areas where previously you had a lot of fragmentation, you're actually going to have market concentration into, you know, at least a geographic kind of regulatory level, single dominant entities who are aggressive, who are on a rapid innovation cycle, more rapid than incumbents, who are aggressively deploying technology and then using that technology and the data assets that they generate with that technology to further cement their competitive position and continue to expand across the like natural boundaries of where their strategic interests lie. And so I think that that's going to broadly happen. And so, you know, necessarily, I think there's probably going to be something that plays out that way in the genomic space. It's less clear to me that it happens at the biotech pharma level. I think that somebody using, you know, kind of gathering like true patient data, matching it against kind of the genomic and then the RNA information coming off and maybe proteomic information coming off those patients, then gives you and it gives the company an angle on, you know, better delivery of care matched with like a better diagnostic platform to tell what's going on with the patient, which then kind of increases basically the health yield you get off of dollars spent on the care given. And maybe also you need to integrate through insurance in some way, less clear about that. But that kind of strategic position probably yields like a very big and interesting company that is, it becomes like, right now it's like, who do I go for my health provision? Like, I, you know, it's a weird mix of, well, this is the insurer, this is the terrible doctor search website I tried to go through, this is like the review I read about the person like has a bad waiting room. Like, I don't know. Like, I, and half the time, you know, you go and you're like, that doctor doesn't seem like really knows what he's talking about, you know? And so like, there's just like a lot of inefficiency, particularly in the US, in how healthcare is provisioned. And so it seems ripe for, with all of the kind of information and data that's coming out now, for somebody to consolidate that space, particularly as everybody's getting shifted into kind of the, you know, online visits. And so then conceptually it's like, why does the doctor have to be, you know, right in your town? So at least at the state level, you could see consolidation. And so I think that's the more likely angle of consolidation. I think that the biotech and drug space, like the way in which consolidation traditionally has happened is a company has like an angle on, like Genentech back in the day did, on recombinant DNA. Then they have like best license to operate because they have IP protection over their spot, which then means the most talented scientists want to work with them because you want to, you know, work with the newest, greatest stuff with the least encumbrances. And so within, you know, the gene editing space, you'd say, okay, well, the gene editing IP owners kind of occupy that spot. But, you know, that's, we think there's going to be cross-licensing deals, but there's some disputes over those patents. And so that could be a mechanism by which consolidation occurs. But generally, you know, if you look at the way we think the overall space is going to develop, there's going to be a lot of advances happening in genomics generally. And we are still so early in kind of our understanding of the body as an ecosystem. And every time you kind of like peel back the layers on what do we actually know here, it's often very little. And we're like, just like biological systems are so massively complex. We just have accessible tools by which to begin to like understand what's actually happening inside the biological system. You know, you could think of like everything to basically like 5 years ago as being like, let's just try things and see if it happens to work. And hey, look, you know, this drug gives people erections. Great, let's sell that thing. You know, I mean, so yeah. So the it has been such a kind of like volume experimentation game. We're getting to where we understand like the mechanics of how things are working and have the tools by which to craft custom drugs to go against it. You know, so there's I think it's just like a very early stage space across the board.
Do you think Teladoc is kind of, I mean, it seems like it's a growing position, your top position in the genomics fund. Regarding the potential to consolidate, is that why you guys are, you know, convicted on Teladoc? What, and do you see Teladoc being able to be in that position to accelerate their lead? What's the context or kind of, you know, background behind your Teladoc position?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of detailed it where, you know, if you are at the basically front end of the patient funnel and you can begin to deliver people a better kind of patient experience and get kind of from your exposure to those patients, manage to improve that experience over time, then that can create this kind of waterfall effect of kind of accumulating patients. And at the same time, and from a clinician perspective as well, if you can get the doctors on board with using your platform, then you can solve a lot of inefficiencies in the market. Like if you talk to any doctor about their electronic health records management system, and you will, like, I've never talked to one that likes what they're using, right? So kind of like there is, between solving problems for clinicians and solving problems for patients, there's just a lot of economic opportunity there. And you know, inclusive of like a really chaotic and disjunct payer system in the US, we think that they're well positioned. Mm-hmm.
It seems like a lot of your research goes back to Wright's law as one of kind of the key drivers, where with every doubling of production capacity, there's a certain percent that the costs go down. Can you kind of share a bit more, like how important is Wright's law to ARK Invest, and does it have a is it in the front of your mind as you research new industries and new companies? Like, how is this company, you know, taking advantage of Wright's law, and does that, you know, come into the whole decision making process of whether to invest in a company or not?
Well, so we always start at the top down. So, you know, we believe there's five technology platforms that are basically that future historians will look back upon and say are roughly as big as the computer or as big as the internet. So for us, it's AI and neural nets, robots, gene sequencing and editing. For now, those are glommed into one platform. Energy storage as relates to mobility and the utility space, and then Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. And so with all of those, we have an expectation for cost decline, or it could be performance improvement at same cost, and kind of unit economics cases that we've developed that show that they cut across sectors, and we expect that their platforms atop which other innovations can be built. And those three characteristics of technologies as a mechanism by which to identify, signpost major technologies are not things that we came up with. That's part of what's called general purpose technology theory. And so, economic historians have looked and said, oh, you can apply these characteristics and this is how you can identify major technologies. So on the cost decline side, we are typically saying, let's figure out how to dimension this cost decline in a robust way over time. And almost always Wright's law is the solution to that if it can be applied. With the example of like AI and neural nets, like Wright's law is hard to apply because you have to have an x-axis, a cumulative doubling that makes logical sense in terms of the performance advance that you're getting. So for instance, when you're looking at batteries, right? You could say, well, actually, it's the number of cells that is the useful doubling factor to pay attention to. And you would get your cost curve wrong because sometimes cell form factor changes to put more kilowatt hours or more, you know, watt hours in an individual cell. And even within right now, we're using kilowatt hours to as a proxy for the cost decline in electric vehicles. But you can, if you think about it, the actual way to apply it specifically to electric vehicles is to say, what is the range performance? And we have a metric for that. The doubling, you know, range performance is the actual unit that people care about. So how much do you have to pay per some range performance amount over time? And then relative to kind of the volume doubling of electric vehicles in market. And so it's not as if you can take it and like, you know, and turn everything into a nail with it. You have to like be careful about your definitions, how you're trying to measure the performance improvement and the cost decline. And then from there, get to what you hope is a robust medium and long-term forecast as to what costs are going to be. So there are academic papers showing that it's like the best, quote, best like generalizable cost decline methodology to use. And it certainly makes a lot more conceptual sense to me than like a Moore's law style forecast, which is like basically costs magically decline every year just on the basis of time has passed. And actually, if you apply it to transistors, Wright's law actually gives you a better forecasting accuracy against transistors than Moore's law did. But Moore's law is like a lot easier to do, which is why people typically do a Moore's law style forecast. With a Moore's law style forecast, you look at last year's price and you look at this year's price and you say, okay, well, there, like I'm done. Whereas to construct a Wright's law forecast, you have to figure out the cumulative volume of production of the thing, figure out, you know, historical prices to figure out the learning rate against that cumulative volume and do a fit to that. And And so it's not, it's actually a lot more work. When it applies, we always try to go through the process of doing that work. With VR, we've done a big rights law forecast, which I think we've unveiled a little of that in our big ideas report. You know, so anywhere where you have like particularly hardware, like rights law tends to be very robust. I think the where it gets tricky is, again, in like the AI space, in the kind of the blockchain cryptocurrency space. Like I can talk about how those are delivering cost declines in rapid and chaotic ways. Within the AI space, I can do cost declines on the hardware chips that enable it, but it's not necessarily applicable to kind of software advances, essentially. And so then you have to be, you know, you have to think about, well, how are we going to determine, yeah, what kind of the capability of an artificial intelligence system is going to be 5 years from now and at what cost? Mm-hmm. That's harder.
Got it. With Rice Law, when you apply it to, for example, electric vehicles, are you breaking it down to different parts? For example, you know, the lithium ion batteries, I think you've said that when it doubles production, the costs go down by 28% or so. Are you applying separate right laws, let's say, for example, to the electric, you know, motors, to, because it seems like if you apply to the doors and, you know, the windows, I mean, that's stuff that's maybe already, you know, like long time ago, right? It's a lot applied, but maybe not today. So how do you break down? Because part of the electric car is batteries. Part of it is, you know, the motors and electronics. Part of it is just the shell and just, you know, more dumb parts. Right. So what's your take?
Yeah. I mean, it's like interesting. If you look back at the original Wright's Law paper from Theodore Wright, right? He did it for overall airplane production and then demonstrated how it also held for the individual line items for like labor that went into it, for the raw materials that went into it. And so it actually tends to stack well, but you're absolutely right. If like if we had the battery cost coming down to below the cost of doors, right? And then continued that cost decline, it would no longer apply because we've been making automotive doors for a long, long time. So right now within the electric vehicle space, we're basically using the battery cost decline and saying this is the percentage of the overall cost of the vehicle that the battery and electric drivetrain will comprise. And so there is an assumption that you're driving efficiencies in the rest of the vehicle that you might not be. But the you know, if you think about like the cost comparison to the Toyota Camry, we're assuming the electric drivetrain will at that point cost essentially the same amount as the internal combustion engine. And so you have the same amount of money to deploy against the rest of the vehicle, right? And so it's likely that those are exactly cost compare or basically quality comparable. As you carry on the cost decline, you say, well, now an electric vehicle costs $18,000, right? Then I'm also assuming that you're spending less on rest of vehicle. So it's probably not exactly kind of quality comparable to the Toyota Camry at that point. Instead, it's probably like, you know, now the Ford Fiesta is being competed against by electric vehicle, whereas before it wasn't. I'll insert a caveat here, which is the way in which Tesla is manufacturing its vehicles and running basically the electronics of its vehicles is totally different from the way that the traditional OEMs are, and that everything is running through the same central computer for Tesla, the windshield wipers, everything else. Like, so they can deliver software upgrades to those individual electronic components in a way that it's just not really possible for traditional OEMs to do. The OEM like sources their windshield wiper assembly from a tier one supplier, and you know, they customize it, they build it into the model. If they want to change the way that that thing operates, well, they have to wait till the next model year. They'll wait 4 years from now to change. They don't really have the ability to go in and be like, oh, it would be fun if our windshield wipers could go like could match the beat of the disco song that plays or something. Tesla, if they thought that would be a fun thing to do, Tesla could and would, and I'm worried that I just said that because maybe they will do that. And that would be, you know, like, so the that vertical integration, that basically digitization of the entire vehicle actually allows for kind of cost advantages across that rest of vehicle line that you could you know, you could say that that line specific to electric vehicles should also decline at some Wright's law rate relative to vehicle production. So within a Tesla, for example, you don't have a rain sensor on the windshield wiper that a BMW does, because Tesla is doing the automatic rain sensing just through the camera that's on the front of the vehicle, whereas BMW has bought the windshield wiper and rain sensor assembly from a tier one supplier, right? And so there are opportunities with a fully digitized vehicle to deliver same or better capability at lower cost. So, you know, it probably will actually be better than the Ford Fiesta at that $18,000 price point, you know, and there is, you can see it now, like if you get in a Tesla and just the digital experience of being in the Tesla, the infotainment screen, everything else, it's better than what you get out of a BMW 5 Series, which it's price competitive with. And so, you know, it's kind of, but it, again, it's like you can't just blanket apply this tool and be like, okay, that's the outcome. You have to be thinking about, well, like, how does this apply here? How do we de-risk this? Or how do we understand what this actually means? And so some of that is like Sam going back and doing the work of like, well, how, you know, what is a Ford Fiesta cost? How much is the drivetrain? How much is rest of vehicle? How are those ratios? How do those ratios change as you get down price point? So even looking at the scooter space, and so then what is the actual implication of cost competitiveness of this particular technology at this price point? So it's not, you know, we try to distill it into easily understood like conclusions and still have that be consistent with the nuances that you begin to understand as you're trying to do the work of generating those conclusions.
Yeah.
Well, one more question real quick about the Tesla analysis you guys do, since you brought that up, that reminded me. I know you guys didn't include energy storage or solar, and I didn't see you include Tesla Semi either. Do you think that's going to be an important part of Tesla's future valuation, their logistics, you know, trucking business? And do you speculate on any other future businesses by 2025? Tesla might have announced like an interest in getting into eVTOL, supersonic jets, for example, or neural networks as a service in the next couple of years with the Dojo, or, you know, do you guys speculate on that much yet, or just anything on that?
Yeah. So we received a lot of questions about the energy business in particular. I'd say that I don't doubt that they will deliver top line growth to that business. The way I think about it is like we think it's strategic to them, particularly on the energy storage side, in that the automotive business is a cyclical business, and you can deliver lowest cost product if you keep your factories 100% utilized. Well, it's hard to keep something 100% utilized when you have a cyclical demand curve. So if you can fill in that demand for battery cells with energy storage products, then, and, you know, potentially you're also taking the cells that come off your supply and you are performance separating them. The more performative cells are ending up in vehicles, the less performative cells are ending up in energy storage. Same with cells that are coming back that you need to recycle back into your system in some way. Then kind of energy storage as a business unit, even though it itself might not be extra normally profitable, can basically allow the electric vehicle and mobility business to run at higher profitability levels than it otherwise would. So that's like, I think of that business as likely, and because their growth is essentially battery cell constrained, that's the governor on their rate of being able to expand. The most profitable like waterfall of where you would deploy battery cells would be in robo-taxis if you could deliver them, vertically integrated ride hail if you can execute on that business plan, then a Tesla insured vehicle, then a traditional Tesla vehicle, and then to an energy storage product. And so kind of like you will always be, that business will be at the tail end of that kind of deployment consideration, at least through kind of the end of our model. We think they're going to be supply constrained the whole way through, right? And so you can think of that business as being a capital efficient way to keep the factory fully utilized, at least on the battery side. On the solar side, I have never been that satisfied with kind of our assessment of solar companies, generally their ability to actually get meaningful cash flow out of their projects relative to cost of capital. So how does Tesla have a potential advantage against other solar companies? They should have lower customer acquisition costs because you're already trying to convince somebody to install like a EV charger in their house. They might as well buy a solar system from you as well. There's also, you know, some incentive to have, you know, battery storage, because if in the event your power goes out and your Tesla's not fully charged, you want to be able to fully charge it before you leave town in the event of an earthquake or something like that. And the solar roof product, I think, is like really interesting, and it's the right take on the market. Like, that's the direction things could go. The problem is people replace the roofs like once every 30 years. You have to, I think, sell into home builders or something, or you know, get architects to use you. Like, it's a very heavy sales lift to get that product installed. And so it's possible it could be a big business for them. And by big, I mean, it's possible it could generate lots of cash flow to them. I think it could deliver top line, and maybe it will. But because we don't have a differentiated perspective on how it will deliver cash flow, we haven't modeled it in. So then the third thing that people have brought up, which is a good point, is, okay, if you have all of these energy storage products like distributed to homes, or, you know, you're selling them to utilities, can you sit in at the software layer and rather than giving all the economics to the home, you automatically bid for power and offload power and you generate some kind of platform fee to yourself? That's possible. And we haven't really modeled it in a, you know, in a way that was sufficient, I thought, to include it in this. Then the final, like, so all like, could deliver top line, unlikely in our view to be the marginal driver of value in the business over 5 years. The virtual like automatic bidding stuff is a potential angle we haven't looked at, and we reserve the right to change our minds. The Tesla Semi, again, I think it's like an interesting product. It will be, you know, if they can deliver EV autonomous trucks, we believe those are going to price competitive with freight rail. So like 3 or 4 cents a ton mile. Right now, it costs you 12 cents a ton mile to ship something across the country by truck. And so could be heavily disruptive to the rest of the kind of freight shipping landscape. And if they can deliver that, they should be able to sell a lot of these. But again, it's they're cell constrained right now. And so like we probably will like work in the Tesla Semi into the ASP table and into the profitability characteristics of the business over time. We did a rough cut of it, and it just wasn't sufficiently meaningful to valuation deviation to try to like basically take the technical risk of trying to build it in and then get it fully tuned so that some random person who's trying to make me look like an idiot could play with the model and have it spit out a weird answer. And so we just didn't build it in at this point.
Makes sense. So they're just like so cell constrained right now. It's like, you know, the automotive robotaxi is the top priority basically for the cells they do have. Funny enough, the solar roof, I'm mute most of the time because today is the first day of a solar roof installation at my house. So hopefully you don't hear too much banging when I unmute myself.
Awesome.
It's my second, my last house I had before this a few years ago before we moved to this house actually was like one of the first paying solar roof customers in the Bay Area. So loved it so much we're getting on our next house right now.
Nice. Full endorsement. Amazing.
Yeah. And then the one other question though, Brett, was what about the future speculation? Like, you know, Tesla, you know, what we're talking sure. about is like if Tesla stays in place and everything we know about Tesla keeps growing. But what about the unknowns that Tesla, like, do you guys speculate on the new things that Elon's going to be introducing, you know, like the eVTOLs or, you know, neural network as a service, or maybe even there's like this new master of coin promotion to Zach Kirkhorn. Maybe that's not just a joke. Maybe there's some kind of digital wallet currency service Elon's dreaming up for when they introduce robo-taxis too. I don't know. I mean, do you guys speculate on that much or, you know, what do you think?
I mean, we certainly talk about, like, if you look at when we began to dimension in the robo-taxi potential for Tesla, they had not, like, Elon hadn't said that's what they were going to do. So for us, it's like once something becomes strategically obvious, even if a company is not going to do it, we'll dimension it in and be like, well, this is how much this could be worth if this company pursues this strategy. Like, leave Tesla aside for a moment, but the Cash App and Square, you know, we began to dimension kind of the full digital wallet implementation and how they were going to begin to build out the full financial services stack on that digital wallet well before they had, you know, we don't wait for them to lay out the strategy. It was so obvious, right? And so then people look at us and say, oh, how can you, the company hasn't told you they're going to do that. How can you possibly try to embed that in evaluation? I would invert it. If you're only doing it after the company, if you're only embedding in your expectations something that is strategically obvious after the company said, well, this is what we're going to do and this is how much revenue we're going to generate off of it, then you miss a lot of the inefficiency in the market. So a lot of the work we do is to think about strategic advantage a company will have. Say, if they pursue this strategy, how will it feed into that strategic advantage? How executionally will they be able to do it? And then what will be the impact on our expectations of value? And when it's meaningful, then begin to like build out the work and say, okay, well, this is how this would look. And, you know, we're not 100% certain they're going to do it, but we're, you know, 30% certain. And then if they pursue the strategy, this is how this should feed into value. And then, hey, let's lay out this playbook. And you know, for so other people can be like, oh, you're an idiot. You didn't think of this or this. And so the company itself can be like, oh, huh. We didn't think of that. Like I remember a conversation with Square's investor relations where I was basically saying, well, this is what we think digital wallets generally, not just for you, but generally what digital wallets will look like. This is the bank branch of the future. And they turned around and said, oh, everybody else is telling us not to say that we're a bank because banks have low multiples. It's like, what are we doing here? Like, it's not that you say you're a bank and then suddenly I apply a bank multiple to you. That's not the way in which at least I underwrite positions. I look at this is what I think 5 years from now a company's going to look like. And then I pretend I'm a forced seller of that company. So one another area that I think, you know, people maybe don't understand how we do things is if you look at our exit multiple for Tesla, the implication is that the company will be trading at something like a 5% cash flow yield 5 years from now. But if you look at the growth rates we think the company is going to be engaged in at that point, there is no way that kind of people are...
I agree.
I shouldn't say no way, but it is unlikely that it would only be trading at a 5% cash flow yield, right? It would likely be trading at a much higher multiple than that. But the valuation work we do is to say, 5 years from now, what does the company look like in our view? What is the cash flow they should be able to scrape off the business if at that time they were trying to maximize margins rather than reinvest in their platform? And then what would a, you know, not me, but like a normal market participant who just pays for cash flow, who's not a technological optimist, what if I were a forced seller at that point, what would that person pay me for that position, right? And so we do that because we're trying to take away kind of like cheat codes that people use. Like, oh, I'm going to pay 35 times earnings for this thing, right? I'm taking enough risk on going forward the time horizon I'm going. Things can go horribly wrong over 5 years, right? You know, a meteor could hit Fremont. Who knows, right? But then I try to not take any risk on the multiple that I imply that the market is going to pay for that business over 5 years. So when Square says, oh, well, banks trade at low multiples, you know, my response is 5 years from now, we're assuming that we're only going to get the multiple that like a traditional financial service entity gets on those lines of the business. And this is the strategy that makes obvious sense within that context. So.
Makes sense. I want to ask you about last mile delivery or last foot delivery. I've been fascinated by this concept of, you know, a autonomous taxis or robo-taxis, vans, et cetera, get goods to the person's driveway, but then from the driveway to the person's door, that's a whole nother feat. I know you've published a bunch of stuff on drones, and you think that, you know, the drone market is going to be huge. I think it's, you're saying something about, you think 20% of parcel delivery will be done by drones in 5 years or so. How do you see that playing out? I mean, will drones eventually, you think, take over almost, you know, vast majority of 90% eventually over time of deliveries, or will there be a combination where you have an autonomous vehicle, van or something, drive up to the porch and then an autonomous robot carry, let's say, the package to the porch? How do you compare those two things, a drone versus, you know, a last foot robot?
Yeah, I mean, I think you are, it wouldn't make sense to fill a van up with packages if you have the ability to have like independent autonomous agents basically at roughly package size getting your items to your endpoint. It's kind of like, you know, if we get autonomous vehicles and the result is that we're using like a 2,000-pound vehicle to still deliver a single pizza, then we have massively failed in terms of our technological implementation, right? And so I think it's more likely that you have a combination of these trundling, rolling robots and drones. And it's heavily contingent upon kind of the regulatory overlay, which will vary geography by geography, and kind of like how well vertically integrated kind of the Amazons of the world, and I guess probably Shopify, get it to but I think that the contingent upon regulatory acceptance and political acceptance, and that these things can't be so loud and annoying that people start like throwing rocks at them and stuff. I think that kind of the parcel drone delivery is the most elegant solution to the problem. And we think it's going to be kind of, you know, call it 25 cents per package. Right now, if Amazon, you know, outsources through UPS or third-party shipping, it's like $7 or $8 and it arrives in 2 days. They can get it from your distribution center to your door in half an hour, and they basically give it to you free within the cost of Prime. It seems like that will drive a large volume of like consumer demand. And within, it's like stuff we've talked about, and I'm not exactly sure how it's going to play out, nor is anybody, but is how does this kind of mesh onto or match onto kind of the food takeout delivery space? There's a lot of opportunity within both grocery and kind of food delivery for these implementations. If you think about like inclusive of kind of changes in the way in which people live. You know, takeout is so convenient now, you don't actually need a kitchen. So that's why people pre-coronavirus were packing into like, you know, shared living arrangements where there's a shared kitchen that's not used very often. Because you're not doing that much cooking because it's as cheap to get takeout. Well, it gets even much more cheap if suddenly it's drone delivered instead of rather than relying on a bike courier or somebody in a car to get it to you. And then, you know, you, the American household, need a gigantic fridge and a gigantic pantry because you only go to the grocery store once a week. And you're basically serving as a retail outlet for yourself where you're like, you know, getting a bunch of packages and laying them in the pantry and then slowly selecting from them. Well, if the cost of delivery collapses, then why go to the grocery store once a week? And the time to delivery collapses. Why go to the grocery store once a week? Why not just like order your groceries for the day when you need them? Like, this is what I'm going to cook. I decide by 3 p.m. I have the ingredients by 3:30, and then you cook, you know? And so then you don't need this ginormous like pantry fridge combination because you're trying to basically save on kind of your time trips to the grocery store. And so kind of like, I think within the food delivery space, it's actually less clear exactly how the business model shake out, as in, is there some, you know, maybe it's Uber or whoever, is there some overlay logistics service that tries to provide a platform to all of the restaurants? Is it Amazon through kind of their Whole Foods footprint? You know, but that's where I think the most kind of economic opportunity unlock resides. Anyway, I think it should make the process of ordering e-commerce like items like even less frictionful, and so you drive a lot of demand for it. I don't believe that it's going to be a robot that like climbs out of the UPS truck, pulls out a package, like climbs up your front steps and leaves it on the step. Like that to me seems like a less likely implementation.
Even with big packages, let's say, you know, like a lot of my packages are quite large, like 3x3x3. And
right.
I mean, for a drone to be able to carry that, like.
Well, so like 80% of Amazon's packages or items that they sell are less than 5 pounds. So you can imagine that like a lot of volume can go through aerial drones. You still, yes, you're not, if you order like a, I don't know, a refrigerator through Amazon Prime, which I'm sure some people do, I don't think that's going to be airlifted into your house, you know? And so, and you'll still have some human in the loop stuff, right? So it's more like, how do you, break out and disaggregate, like which packages still fit human in the loop. And it's possible that you have some kind of autonomous truck that comes around and some kind of like humanoid robot that gets out and lifts up the package and drops it on the front step. But that to me seems like it's such a, it so obviously seems like using technology to try to recreate old technology. It's like building a mechanical horse or something. That's probably not the solution that ends up working.
Interesting.
I don't know what it is, but
yeah. For drones, I mean, do you think Tesla has a chance to enter the drone space and to have a dominant position? I mean, what's your take? What percent do you think of the becoming the market leader for drones is vision, autonomous, you know, basically flying, maneuvering, and all of what Tesla's been building with neural nets and computer vision versus more of the mechanical, you know, the actual flying mechanisms and all that. What's your take? Do you think it's, is it even a big enough market for Tesla to care about? Or is it something where Tesla combines it with, you know, the autonomous driving networks they have and drones to create some type of all-in-one vertical, you know, delivery, logistics, service, and infrastructure? What's your thoughts?
I mean, I think that you're probably more performance sensitive on your battery energy density, then you, I see like autonomously navigating a drone is a lot easier than a car because you're in 3D space. You don't have, you know, you don't have a lot of like, even if the sky is full of drones, it's still just like drones that are around you rather than like people on bicycles and random things spilling into the street. Like, so I think their competitive edge on computer vision, while it should translate into that, it's like Skydio, which is massively less resourced than Tesla, is clearly delivering with a set of cameras on a drone, like magical capabilities within that system to kind of like navigate around the world. So I would think that if they were to compete, it would, and also I don't think that the airframe is necessarily a differentiator either. I think there's probably differentiation capability within the battery energy density and that same cost drone you should be able to allow to go farther or carry more weight or whatever performance metric you want. But ultimately, it seems likely to me that some kind of vertical integration through other logistics services is the winning play there. And so like, that's why, you know, Amazon's going after it because like you described, like, or I described, the refrigerator isn't going to be transported by drone. You, the consumer, aren't going to be like, oh, I need to buy from this other company because they can't deliver refrigerators. They can only deliver packages less than 5 pounds. Right. And so kind of like the, it seems like you need to have like a, to vertically integrate, have drone capability, have rolling robot capability, have like traditional human capability, have like trucking and stuff. So it's less clear to me that Tesla would have a competitive edge going after that space. I guess it depends on what happens with the semi and kind of their logistics network. But at first, I guess pass, I'd say, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, from like transport, you could say, you know, transporting people from point A to point B is one aspect of, let's say, autonomous driving, removing the human, right, from the equation. Logistics, let's say transporting a good from point A to point B, there's massive humans involved in that whole process, adding costs and complexity. The company to actually remove all of that human cost from, you know, getting good from point A to point B, it seems like, you know, would be a massive winner in the logistics space, you know. In that frame, do you think Tesla, have you guys modeled anything or explored any things where Tesla actually decides to be the point A to point B, that whole, the vertical, you know, start to finish logistics provider for moving goods? And I mean, or is that just kind of more far out after, you know, they solve autonomous driving, something to consider?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, I haven't, you know, I think it certainly makes the Tesla Semi potentially a better strategic asset to them. Yes, you can see how the building blocks of it could move into that logistics space. Let's put it that way. I mean, it's like, you know, conceptually, what some implementation of autonomous vehicles is, it's like, for instance, dropping my kid off at school today, I had forgot my kid's backpack, so she doesn't have a sweatshirt at school. She'll live, right? But if there was a, like, if I could have, like, texted my wife and been like, throw her backpack in an autonomous car and it'll cost, you know, $1 to get to school, and then somebody at school would go out and get it, I clearly would have done that, right? So these things are going to be used to transport things. I could imagine, yeah, full chain of custody being a solution that Tesla realizes it can provide and that it seeks to do so. And like, consistent with at least the way they've approached the world so far, they would probably like try to do it in a vertically integrated manner.
I mean,
we haven't really, I mean, other than our discussion of it right now, we have not mentioned it at all. And our underwriting of like, what is the unit economics for like the Tesla Semi and EV autonomous trucks. Like, we've done work there. We have a different perspective on how robotaxi is going to play out from maybe how Tesla does, in that we think it's very likely that optimal strategy for them is to have owner operators of the vehicle who are operating fleets city by city. Whereas Tesla at this point might think that, hey, we're going to try to manage this whole thing ourselves. And I think that within, you know, as you get into the messiness of local geography and kind of local practice, it becomes harder to efficiently kind of manage kind of vertical integration. And, you know, like, my belief is they're going to have assets in play, right? That, so if you imagine that they deliver autonomous capability by software upgrade to every Model 3 for anybody that wants to pay for full self-driving, well, then an operator is going to go around and try to scoop up all of the vehicles to run like a taxi service, essentially. And then Tesla will be able to control profitability of those taxi services by tweaking the platform fee that they charge. But it's a way to incentivize operators to like keep the vehicles clean, keep them charged, like figure out all the mechanics of how you operate in that market. Like, where do you do your parking lots? Like, what is optimum kind of utilization of the vehicles? How many do you need? It like cuts out a lot of complexity for them that I think they'll realize that it's the right strategy. And so similarly, you could imagine like trying to chain together and vertically integrate a whole logistics network. Talk about an execution challenge, right? And it would, like, because nobody's going to use you, or it's going to be hard to win business on just a single quarter, right? You're going to need to provide a whole network. And so it does seem like a big, huge, heavy, yeah, like decade or two decade lift to kind of build out that network, rather than, you know, if you sell the EV autonomous trucks into operators that already have a network and you're charging a platform fee off of that, it's much more cash flow accretive without nearly the execution risk. And maybe you get into kind of the local delivery space with your assets in some way, but I just don't know that that kind of vertically integrating all the way through is within kind of the strategic bandwidth they have. They're doing a lot already.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, I'd like to do a 30-second pitch for you guys to think about. If Tesla can take, let's say, just West Coast from the ports, take this Tesla Semi autonomous, right, and then, you know, ship them to West Coast warehouses, and let's say Tesla starts an e-commerce business just for, you know, West Coast initially, and so they have the semi-autonomous delivering from port to warehouse. Then they have robots that they've developed, you know, to warehouse and store stuff. And then they have Sprinter van type of autonomous driving vans, right? Load up the stuff, deliver it. And if they can have, you know, either, so they have a combination of Tesla drones that take the smaller, you know, packages and food, and food as well, right, to customers. But the larger packages, they have either a combination of autonomous Tesla vans, you know, delivering it to points, or if they can have some type of unloading robot that actually delivers to the porch, if they can actually solve that whole, you know, kind of port from port boat to porch, you know, and do and remove the human mostly from that equation. Sure, there'll still be humans at different parts, but if they can remove the human from parts of that, if they're 4 years ahead of everyone else, including Amazon, then could that carve out, you know, different opportunities for Tesla to get into besides just transportation, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's possible. I think there is a, even if you look at, Amazon had all the incentive in the world to like kind of do their own logistics, and they relied on third-party logistics for a long, long time, right? And only began to vertically integrate through logistics once they had massive volumes across a national footprint, you know, and even then they're having to like piece it together, right? Like they are building out the duplicated logistics network of UPS and FedEx and USPS, I guess. But they're only able to do so because they can then rely upon kind of the third party providers to fill in gaps that they have. It's, you know, who knows, but it seems to me that like the logistics networks are really, they have natural monopoly characteristics that make them difficult to displace. And so you can't, it's like the problem with that vision is like, just West Coast, I think, puts you at a severe competitive disadvantage in a way that is hard to overcome. So then it's like, you have to do it all at once, or you're not going to win. And so if you have to do it all at once, like the capital intensity is so high.
Got it.
And Tesla's in a capital intensive enough business as is. But I mean, again, I think that that's part of the reason we try to underwrite on 5 years is because it's kind of achievable, right? Like as you get further and further out, then you get more into like kind of, I guess you give yourself so much leeway, you could convince yourself of almost anything, right? And so then it's kind of like your basis of like how do I have the probabilities of this happening right gets more and more diffuse. Mm-hmm. And so your error ranges blow out and then you're not sure that you're, you know, quantifying anything or not. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, I think that the idea is provocative. Like, yeah. I it's kind of like the idea of them on selling Dojo and neural net training as an infrastructure as a service player. You can see how, you know, maybe because they are the volume kind of like neural net training company, at least in terms of an individual vertical application, that gives them an angle by which they have to build up their own data center anyway, maybe to like efficiently deploy that data center against their teams, they have to set up a series of APIs to access it. So then let's open up the APIs and let's build a lot of data centers. And suddenly, you know, the car company has become the next compute infrastructure provider. That's possible. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, they're not at a point where even I feel like we can really dimension the strategic optionality there. They haven't built the data center, you know? And so kind of like, it's the kind of exercise we might engage in and then be like, and let's see if this begins to play out. If they begin to unlock that capability, then we want to like begin to deploy and dimension what it looks like.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So I've got so much stuff, but I'm going to pare it down to maybe the last 10 things, but I want to do a lightning round to get maybe a 30 to 60 second kind of quick thoughts on these topics, which I feel like can be an hour each. But first, blockchain. Have you guys considered Cardano or Ethereum or some of these other blockchains besides Bitcoin? And why do you guys, you know, lean toward Bitcoin?
Gosh, a 60-second answer. Bitcoin has a clear value proposition and delivers clear economic utility today. I think Ethereum and the smart contracting platforms generally are also extremely interesting and are a totally different set of exposures. And so, you know, we've done a fair amount of work on Ethereum and smart contracting and thinking about NFTs and all of that. And, you know, within, you know, we do advise clients on exposures to some of those assets as well. So there's a lot of technical risk with Ethereum, and it's less clear what the ultimate market value potential is. With Bitcoin, I can say with some assurance, like, you can just look at, hey, it's digital gold. If it displaces this much gold, this is how much it should be worth. And so there's both less kind of underwriting risk in terms of like value as it kind of displaces an asset, and less technical risk in that it's not trying to transition to proof of stake.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Metaverse, where is all this headed with the metaverse, Roblox? Are you guys bullish on it? And is Roblox kind of the big play, or are there other kind of opportunities you guys are looking into?
I think, yes, it seems clear to us that people will spend an increasing percentage of their discretionary time in some kind of virtual space or experience, and that the winning or the most interesting business models there are the ones providing that virtual space platform and able to collect a platform fee off of all of the economic activity that happens in that space. So you could look at Roblox or Minecraft. You could look at the game engines like Unity or Epic's Unreal Engine. You could claim that, Grand Theft Auto potentially occupies the spot. I think that there's a lot of interesting and different ways to play it, but I think that virtual item sales generally is going to soak up an increasing amount of discretionary money that people use for social status signaling. And so positioning yourself to be the platform that has a take rate on all those virtual item sales is the right spot to be.
Awesome. How important is it for ARK Invest to actually listen to management interviews, trying to get the quality of the CEO, you know, founder CEOs? Like, what's the priority or, you know, importance you guys place on that versus, let's say, other criterias?
Every company we assess on people management and culture, product leadership, barriers to entry, and ability to execute. And so the people management and culture layer is almost always the first. And that involves assessment of management, clarity of mission, kind of how is the kind of workforce motivated, you know, how much kind of an ownership culture is their ability to kind of quickly make decisions and execute on them within the execution side. And then also, is it a heterogeneous kind of group of thinkers? Like, we'll look at diversity at the board level and at the management level and see that as a real benefit to companies. So that's a combination of, you know, speaking to management, listening to management, seeing what they've written, seeing how they communicate to kind of their employees, seeing kind of all the way down to like how is the organization itself structured.
Got it. Where does ARK Invest get its name, ARK? Is there a story or a meaning behind that?
Not necessarily. I think there's very, like, it's, some people say it's an acronym for active research knowledge, but it's a short three-letter recognizable trademark. So that's the main thing.
Awesome. And you mentioned you're a Tesla owner. What Tesla do you have, and when did you get it?
I have a Model X and a Model 3. I got the Model X in 2017.
Oh, wow. Okay. Awesome. So you've been a long time. Do you have full self-driving beta yet, or just autopilot?
No, just autopilot.
Autopilot. Okay.
I mean, yes, I'd love to experiment with the beta.
Yeah.
I am sure it is, you know, like, I believe the videos that show that it's not very capable right now, right? Like, the point of, like, people lay out the framework, like, of, I don't know what metrics the consultants are using, but it's like strategic execution, whatever, and they cluster a bunch of things in the bottom right, and then they put Tesla in the bottom left. It's like, it's not a question of where you are now, right? It's a question of what does your distribution look like and what is your trajectory of improvement and reasonable trajectory of improvement given the assets you have at your disposal. So there's an implicit assessment that and one of the big changes we made from last year's Tesla model to this year is we think that the odds of delivering commercial robotaxi service are 50%, whereas last year we thought 30%, right? And so it's not an assessment of full self-driving beta that yields that. Instead, it's looking at the complexity of the problems that it turns out that neural nets can solve is much broader than even people thought, 18 months ago. You know, that GPT-3 can basically not solve language, but that natural language generation processing is so much more capable, that AlphaFold, you can solve protein folding, which, we've been trying to solve for 50 years, that within the game playing space, you can design systems that win not just at like very, very quantifiable games like Go, but like very open-ended concealed games like Dota, those capabilities exist and people weren't sure that they did, is indicative that using this tool against a very rich data set, you should be able to solve this very complex problem in a robust way.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And Emmett, do you have a last question or so?
Yes. Yeah. I have a couple of quick questions too. So Brett, I've heard in the past that ARC has like brainstorming sessions. Is that true? And if so, what's the format like for your kind of like brainstorming sessions?
Yeah. So on Fridays, for as long as I have worked with Kathy, we have had meetings that are have external and internal participants. And typically the way it works is, and these are about the technology landscape, so it's not stock specific. It's more like, this is, for instance, the latest neural net paper that came out. This is how we think it plays what it's indicative of in terms of the capability of neural networks. And then let's talk a little bit about how kind of different products and services can interact with that. And so, it's usually like four or five topics that we cover, and it's a way for us to understand how the strategic landscape is changing. Typically the topics that are talked about go into our newsletter that's released over the weekend. So you can kind of get a sense of what we talk about by subscribing to our newsletter. And it really helps us to like keep abreast of the world and the competitive landscape as it's shifting. And it's for us particularly important because technologies are increasingly like cutting across each other. So, understanding how does AlphaFold like play into our expectations for value of clinical trial pipelines? Like, well, you have to have an understanding of how AlphaFold works and why they were able to do this, and an understanding of how to value a clinical trial pipeline. And so kind of Ali, who covers the kind of biotechs companies, needs to understand AlphaFold to some degree, and Will, who covers AI now, needs to understand what the commercialization potential of AlphaFold might be within a clinical trial. And so it allows kind of that meeting to occur as well.
Great. And do you guys fully, appreciate how successful you guys have grown over the past few years? I mean, you guys have really gone from everyone in the retail world knows who you are, and institutional world as well. But I think you guys have grown tremendously in popularity and so forth. Like, how do you envision ARC in the future if this kind of success keeps growing exponentially for the next few years? Like, what do you see anything changing, or how does ARC leverage this success to change things in the future? Any thoughts on that?
I mean, we're approaching the world in the same way that we always have. And the way in which we've been successful is to think deeply about the future state of the world, to exploit inefficiencies in the public equity market in terms of the duration over which people underwrite assets, where basically there's all kinds of business pressure for people to be short-term focused in the finance world, and having analysts look at technologies themselves rather than being sector specialized, and because the technologies cut across sector, that creates another inefficiency. And then being open and transparent about what we believe, because these technologies are platforms atop which other technologies are going to be built, it's very easy to suffer from a failure of the imagination. And so, you know, continuing to operate kind of transparently and technology focused and over a duration that's appropriate to the equity markets is, I think, how we will, you know, continue to accrue share within the marketplace.
All right. I think we're needing to wrap up because of time, but wanted to thank you, Brett. You know, this conversation actually for me personally has been super enlightening and helpful. It actually shows me a lot of the super long-term thinking that you guys are doing at ARK, where it feels like you guys are working backwards a lot from some of these huge trends that you guys see as inevitable, but you guys see where it's going 10, 15 years or whatever down the road. And then you kind of work backwards into, you know, more medium term, you're talking about five-year price targets, but then also kind of understanding the companies and the players that are, you know, in the field today and what they're doing and what they will do even before they know what they will do, because you guys are seeing the future, you know, so like that's, it just seems like you guys are really trying to get clarity on the long term, you know, and what the factors, the main factors are driving the long-term picture is. And it's just super impressive. Wanted to, thank you for just sharing that perspective and your time with us today.
Yeah, thanks very much, Brett. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right. Talk to you later. Bye.
All right. Bye.